Questions on anything? So, green dots and purple dots. So, you know, you've got those home labs one and two to work on, and if I don't have an email from you, it didn't happen, right? So you need to check out, hopefully provide me with a look at what you did, either by bringing me hard copy or by scanning it and putting in an email. But irregardless, if I don't have an email, it didn't happen, and you won't get credit for it. And I don't know, to make sure that we all agree on who's got an email, there are green dots to indicate who has turned in home lab two, and there are purple dots for, I think, the three people who have turned in home lab one. And home lab two is basically over with. Home lab one, you have until kind of this week to work on it. Home lab one is the moon one. Questions? So for the last exam, we had this big culmination problem. Kind of the equivalent for the next exam is to know constellations. So what I'll do in a while is I'll bring up pictures of dots on the overhead projector, and I'll ask you what constellation is represented by those dots. So just dots, no lines, what's the constellation? So the list of constellations you're supposed to learn is online. There are flashcards there to help you learn those constellations. And I guess the only warning I'd give you is that, you know, what you can do on the web is pretty, you know, you're limited to the 72 dots per inch resolution on the screen. So things look a little bit grosser on the web than they look in real life, where you have lots more dots. So we'll start, I don't know when exactly we'll start that, but it'll be the 10-point question on the next exam, and we'll practice it three or four times before that exam. Questions? Well, so we said that Newton focused on the change in things and how changes were caused by forces. There's a different way of looking at Newton's stuff. So it's not fundamentally new. It's just reformulating what Newton said. And instead of focusing on what's changing, focus on what stays the same. And we have three great conservation laws. Conservation law is a law that something stays constant to talk about. So probably the most important conservation law is the conservation of energy. It's also called the first law of thermodynamics. And it says that while energy can come in lots of different forms, if you add up the amount of energy in all of the forms in a closed system, then the energy has to be a constant. So we have energy of motion, we have potential energy, we have heat energy, we have all these different types of energy, but if we add them up, they should stay constant. So, you know, here's kind of a yo-yo sort of demo that shows this. I'm giving this thing lots of gravitational potential energy by raising it up, and when it falls, it's converting that gravitational potential energy to kinetic energy, mostly rotational kinetic energy. But if we follow it over time, there'll be some penduling kinetic energy. And in the end, it'll stop. And of course, that needs some explaining, because the energy is going to be constant. The stopping comes about because of friction. So the energy is gradually being converted from these organized forms into disorganized thermal energy. And remember, we said that what temperature is and what thermal energy is that it's vibrations of the atoms that make up the solid. So a solid is a lattice of atoms like this, but it's always in motion. There's always some disorganized kinetic energy that's associated with it. And temperature is a measurement of the amount of kinetic energy per particle. So if we have a hot object with a high temperature, we have a lot of vibration. If we have something that's close to absolute zero, there'd be very little vibration. Okay, so heat is a form of kinetic energy. It's just disorganized atomic kinetic energy. Okay, so conservation of energy, first law of thermodynamics. If you add up the amount of energy in a closed system, it's got to remain constant. Conservation of momentum. So momentum is mass times velocity. And if you look at a closed system, so you include both the pusher and the pushee. So for example, if you think about a rifle recoil when you're standing on ice, the bullet goes fast in one direction and you go slowly in the other direction. Same amount of momentum, just in opposite directions, so it adds up to zero. Low mass, high velocity bullet, high mass, low velocity skater, all adding up to zero. So in the case of a binary star system, we have star A pulling on star B and star B pulling on star A, and they're both basically in orbit around each other. So it's kind of hard to demonstrate conservation of momentum because we need large straight line systems. And actually, more important for astronomy is angular momentum anyway. So if we have things that are moving in a circle, and again, if we have a closed system, so we're including both the rotator and the rotatee, the total amount of angular momentum is a constant. So momentum is mass times velocity. Angular momentum is kind of the same thing. For rotational velocity, we have the number of RPMs, and the thing that corresponds to mass, which is called the moment of inertia, is roughly speaking the mass times the radius squared. So if we have two equal mass objects, this one has the mass at the largest possible radius, and this one has the mass evenly distributed, this one is harder to spin. It has the equivalent of more mass. So if we try and race these guys, it's the one that has the smaller moment of inertia, the mass closer to the spin axis, that wins. The ability to do the equivalent of changing mass allows us to play this ice skater game, which is an important phenomena that you just saw before, right? So if you have mass that's distributed and you bring that mass in close to your body, you can change the orbital speed, the rate at which you're spinning at. And in fact, it's conservation of angular momentum that's responsible for Kepler's second law, which you remember is this funny thing about the area that's swept out being the same every day, which results in the fact that when the planet is close to the Earth, when its mass is has a smaller radius, then it's moving faster than when it's far from the Earth. Gyroscopic effects. So if there's no twisting force on a spinning object, it'll spin forever with exactly the same axle. And that's a pretty close approximation to what's going on with the Earth, right? It's spinning, pointing at the pole star, and at least during our lifetime, that's not going to change. But we saw that if there's a small twisting force, the gyroscope resists that force. So for example, this is just a little toy gyroscope that's in a pipe, and obviously this thing rolls just fine if I roll it down the inclined plane. But if I have the gyroscope in here, it will resist that motion. Gyroscopes try and point in a balanced gyroscopes try and point in a constant direction. I'm trying to thread the needle here. Okay, now let's see if I can wind it up. So I claim that if this gyroscope is spinning inside this pipe, it will resist that rotation. It'll try to point in a fixed direction, and you'll see the result. I'm spinning it up now. And it doesn't want to roll anymore. It wants to point in a fixed direction. And if you just hold on to a gyroscope and you try and spin it in your hand, you'll see it's resisting. And probably the easiest way to demonstrate this, you can come up after class to try it, is if you have just a common bicycle wheel, so you know that this is pretty everyday sort of stuff, and it's a very unimpressive demonstration, but if I try and twist this, it's fighting me in a very funny way. When I try and twist it this way, it actually pushes in a perpendicular direction. And kind of the demonstration of that is that. Obviously, this thing would like to fall, but instead of falling, it twists around in a circle, precesses. Okay, so that's what's happening with the Earth. The Earth, if it were a perfect sphere, it would have a fixed direction of rotation, but it's slightly elongated along the equator, about 0.5%. and the moon is pulling on it, and it's providing a very small twisting force on the Earth, trying to twist the spin axis of the Earth to point towards the moon, which it doesn't. And because of that small twisting force, the result isn't that the Earth orients itself to the moon. Instead, the spin axis of the Earth goes under this very slow precessional motion, which the Greeks were the first people to notice. Right, so for Aristotle, Polaris was not the pole star. There's a very gradual shift in the direction of the spin axis over the millennia. Okay, so conservation of angular momentum is responsible for lots of things in astronomy, the ice skater effect, and the slow precession of the Earth's spin axis. Questions on that? Well, there's maybe something that deserves a little bit of explanation. We talk about there being an energy crisis, but if energy is conserved, every bit of energy that has ever been produced is still with us, right? It can't be created or destroyed. So what does it mean to have a shortage of energy if it's all still there? Yeah, so what the second law of thermodynamics says is that while you can't use up or produce energy, it can be degraded into this disorganized kinetic energy, and you can't get it back. So we can have a coal-fired power plant that sends its cooling water into Lake Superior, but we can't take the heat that's in Lake Superior back and put it back in the power plant and run our generators. The energy is still there, but in this disorganized fashion, there's basically no way of getting it back. And the fancier way of describing that is in terms of disorder. And the $2 word for disorder is entropy. And what the claim is of the second law of thermodynamics is that in a closed system, disorder always increases. So the universe is always more disordered today than it was yesterday. And there's nothing we can do to tidy it up. If we tidy up a little bit of it someplace else, it must get more disorganized as a result of our tidying action. Now it's a little bit funny, the conservation laws and Newton's laws, those are universal laws. And you remember that, of course, would drive Aristotle crazy, right? The idea that the apple and the moon are governed by the same mechanics would have been crazy. But here Newton's claiming that everything works the same way, and these are the laws of motion that every piece of the universe has to obey. The laws of thermodynamics are a little bit different. Those are statistical laws. So mostly what the second law of thermodynamics is saying is it's overwhelmingly unlikely to ever have disorganized energy be organized. So it doesn't violate a law of physics one of Newton's laws, maybe I should say, in order to get organized, but it's just incredibly unlikely because of the nature of the atomic motion to get it reorganized. Questions? Well, let's take advantage of the being able to demonstrate some aspects of conservation of angular momentum again using the spin table. So first of all, let's think about the equivalent of the rifle recoil case. So in the rifle recoil case, we have shooting a gun at high speed, so the bullet goes fast in one direction, and the person has to recoil in the other direction. And of course, what has to happen is that the total amount has to add up to zero before and after. And we can do the same thing with angles if we want, right? So I can step on the spin table and try and stop myself. And if I shoot the bullet, if I spin this thing fast in one direction, then I have to recoil, I have to go slowly in the other direction. And if I stop this, I have to stop. Okay, so if I rebalance myself, so I'm going to try and spin this thing quickly in this direction, I have to recoil by going in the other direction. So it works the same way, just with angles. We can do kind of more complicated processes if you think about it. So if we, here's the spin table. And if I jump on to the spin table with the bicycle wheel rotating quickly that way, if I just, so this adds up to zero, right, horizontally. If I just bring the bicycle wheel up, so it's now spinning that way, it has to still add up to zero, so I have to be spinning the other way. And if I simply reverse the spin of the wheel by turning it upside down, then I have to spin the other way so that it's counterbalancing it. It all added up to zero to start with. If it's conserved, it has to continue to add up to zero. Okay, so let's see. So I claim if I put this thing up, I go one way. If I put this thing down, I go the other way. If I bring this back to where I started with, I end up being fixed. Well, let's see. So the question is, if I walk on this with this thing up, will I stop spinning? And the answer is basically no. But if I stop it, I have to get all of that angular momentum, and then I start to spin. So I can sit there with this thing spinning. I have exactly the same amount as I had to start with, right? It's all here. And none with me. But if I stop it, then I have to grab it all. Okay. So conservation law, things have to add up to zero. And it's true for momentum just as it is for angular momentum, but it's a lot easier to generate it, to show it with angular momentum than with linear momentum. So let's take a look at, I don't know if this is a practical application of this or not, but so if we have an astronaut who has separated himself from the door of the space shuttle, what can he do to get himself back? Right, so there isn't anything to push against, so you can't swim through the air. Right, you can do the twist all you want out there in space, but it's not going to get you any place close to the spacecraft. So is there anything you can do except run out of oxygen? I mean, you can't push on yourself. It doesn't achieve anything. Yeah, so if you take something that you can, that's not connected to you, if you're able to throw it away, you will, doesn't matter how light it is, right? You can take a pin and click it that way, and you won't have a very fast recoil velocity, but you'll have a constant recoil velocity, and you'll head in the right direction. But unless you throw something away, you're stuck. So let's think about kind of the equivalent thing for angles, right? So we do the following experiment. You take your wife's cat, and you hold it upside down, and you drop it. It's a cat. It's a perfect drawing of a cat. Can tell by the ears. Do we need a little nose and some whiskers? I don't know. I don't think that helped, actually.
No.
So you want this labeled, huh? Cat. So you take your wife's cat and you hold it upside down and you drop it. Not recommended unless you've been married for 15 years. And even then, it's iffy. But, so unlike the astronaut, if you watch, the cat can change its angle. And it will, if you give it enough space, it will, boy, it's a, it, now it has a fluffed up tail, which is appropriate.
It's a squirrel.
Boy, they're pretty bad, aren't they? I'm not sure that that doesn't look like a turtle. It doesn't work with turtles. So the cat is able to change its angle without throwing anything away. And although the cat wouldn't survive in a vacuum, it would work in a vacuum too. So ideas of what the cat can do. Yeah, so if it spins its tail this way, then its body has to spin the other way. And then it just waits till its body is down and it stops spinning its tail, and it should stop. Right, so I'm not equipped with a tail, but I am equipped with a rotating part when I carry this. So I can turn around by spinning this thing, and then I can stop it, and I end up where I was. Okay, so it all has to add up to zero. If it starts at zero, I can spin my tail and have lots of momentum pointing to the left, and I have to point, my body has to go the other direction. And so, you know, scientists are weird sort of people. You can perform surgery on your wife's cat, definitely, definitely not recommended. Turns out that my sister's family actually has a cat that doesn't have a tail. And it still works, right? Because it's got other movable limbs. But I hope it's clear that if you, right, eventually you get the dead cat bounce effect, right? Where it's not able to reorient itself. Well, it's lived with me long enough and survived, so. Okay, so questions on conservation laws. So we've got one last topic from mechanics to talk about, and it's a topic that Galileo got wrong, Newton got right, and it's the tides. So my guess is that lots of you have been at spring break down to a nice warm ocean. What's the story on tides? You're all Minnesotans who have never been even as far south as Iowa. How do tides work?
Well, the moon.
No. So what are tides? When do they occur? What mean? Without knowing anything, just going to the beach, what does one learn about tides?
Certain parts of the day, the water is going further up.
Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes the water is higher than others. How frequently does that occur? Pretty much twice a day. If you look carefully at the tide table, you'll notice that it's a little bit more. That the separation is more like 25 hours than 24 hours between two successive high tides. They do gradually shift through the day. So I think one high tide per day seems like it's easy to explain, right? So here's the Earth, here's the water of the Earth, which is being attracted to the moon, right? And because the moon is closer to this water than it is to the Earth, there's a bigger force on the water than there is on the Earth. I'm, of course, way overestimating it. Remember, the force goes like 1 over r squared. So that's why the water is moving ahead of the Earth as a whole. And that's kind of what Galileo figured, but it doesn't work, right? Because if we're standing on the spinning Earth, then we're going to get one high tide per day. And that's not the case. So it absolutely has to be the case that there's a high tide there too. So that as the Earth spins, we're carried through two high tides per day. And the reason it's a little bit more than 24 hours between two successive high tides is, of course, the moon is moving. So, how do we figure that? Right, gravity is not repulsive, it's only attractive. So what's going on there?
Would it be the Earth balancing itself?
Well, but I don't know what that means.
Like the cat.
No, this is totally separate from the cat. So, I've never been super successful at explaining this, but let's see if it works any better for you than for other people. So let me kind of replace the Earth by three balls. The center ball represents the Earth, and this ball represents one high tide. And this represents the other high tide. What's the future of the system? Well, this ball, since it's closer to the moon, feels the biggest force. And so it's going to be falling the fastest. The Earth feels, since it's further away, is going to have a smaller force on it. And this water is going to have a smaller force still on it. Again, greatly exaggerated. And so what's going to happen is that the water on the right is going to move ahead of the Earth, and the water on the left is going to fall behind the Earth. And so the separation is going to increase. Okay, so the far high tide has to do with the water being left behind by the Earth. Now, what people don't like about this explanation is it sure looks like everything's going to crash into the moon if it's falling into the moon. But that's the usual story, right? It's possible to be falling all the time and never hitting if you're in fact going in a circle. So the Earth and the moon are part of a binary system that both of them are rotating around. I see from the looks on your faces that you're just as impressed as previous classes. So you may notice that there aren't tides on the sag, right?
Yes.
So you have to have a pretty big body of water. And apparently you can measure tides on Lake Superior, but they're not noticeable. So you need a big body of water that could be sloshed around, like the Atlantic or the Pacific. So the place where high tide is in the Atlantic, it's going to be swishing across. Well, the Earth is going to be rotating under it, as it were, but it's easier to take a geocentric point of view. That high tide is going to be swishing across the Earth as the Earth rotates. And in some sense, that high tide is always going to be pointed to the moon as the Earth rotates underneath it. Does that kind of make sense? So if you were to look at high tide times, you know, across the Atlantic Ocean, that high tide times would be different at different spots. So it should. So of course, the Antarctica, there's no water at the pole, and we usually have ice coverage at the North Pole. So as far as I know, there isn't any noticeable difference there. But yeah, the story should tell you that the tides should be bigger at the equator than at the poles. More questions? Well, we got, you know, some more of these kind of sleazy videos that are useful. Are useful, I think, to understand what's going on. And you can play with them yourself by going to that website. I'm kind of looking for my glasses so I can see what I'm doing, but I don't see them. So let's start by reminding us about this teeter-totter effect, right? So here's two things that are orbiting around each other, and the yellow one doesn't literally orbit around the blue one with the blue one fixed. They're both in orbit. So the Earth and the Earth's water is in orbit around the moon, just as the moon is in orbit around the Earth. And so it's possible for the Earth to be constantly falling towards the moon, but not hitting, just because it's moving fast enough sideways that it's avoiding hitting the moon. And I hope it's clear that if we make the mass very discrepant, if I make this one much more than the other one, then the circle, the teeter-totter point, is going to be shifted closer and closer to the more massive object. And there's a huge mass difference between the Earth and the Moon, so actually it is like this, where the teeter-totter point is inside of the Earth for the Earth-Moon system. Okay, so here's the situation with the faster, slower. So here's the situation, and this picture is showing us a couple of things that are beyond what I've talked about. So I always talked about the moon being the source of the tides, but of course the sun also has a tidal force. So when we have the moon and the sun in the same line, then we have a particularly big tide, so-called spring tide. When we have the moon and the sun acting at 90 degrees, then we have relatively small tides, so-called neap tides. The other thing that's present in this picture that is true and a little bit subtle is that the tidal bulge actually doesn't point exactly towards the moon, because kind of the tides are carried forward by the spin of the Earth. Okay, so the amount of that leading is different at different spots. So if you actually go, you know, to your favorite beach and look at high tide and go and see if the moon is on the meridian, it often won't be on the meridian. Okay, so when we're moving towards a spring tide, as we are now, with the moon and the sun in a line, they're both causing the elongation in the same direction, and we're going to stop. So we didn't go on to the next neap tide. So we had a spring tide, and now we're going to have a neap tide where the moon and the sun are acting at a 90 degree angle to each other. The moon is the bigger cause than the sun, so it kind of wins, but they do better when they combine. Questions?
I still don't really understand when the moon and the sun are both in the same direction, whether it's tied on the opposite side.
So
it's hard to
copy. So Galileo got it wrong, so you're in good stead. And I gave you my so the sun is basically irrelevant to your picture, right?
Yeah.
So with just the moon, we still have two high tides per day. And the logic is basically that the Earth, this picture shows the Earth fixed, which is, you know, not in fact correct. The Earth is in an orbit, and it's constantly falling, and the water on this side is basically being left behind by the falling Earth. So because there's a bigger distance between this water and the moon than there is the Earth, it feels a smaller force, and so it has a smaller acceleration. So it's not, like I say, Galileo got it wrong, so it's not exactly obvious. It's kind of easy to understand why there's a high tide that's pointing towards the moon. You have to think one step further on to realize that if the water that's towards the moon is moving ahead, then it must mean that the water that's on the far side is moving behind. Right? So it's really, this leading lagging is really just the same thing as leading lagging here. More questions?
I guess when you say we're constantly falling, we're moving, but
Moving, but so you remember Newton's picture, right, of the cannonball, right? The cannonball is always falling, but it's moving fast enough sideways so that the distance it falls per second is matched by the curvature of the Earth. So the same thing in the binary star system. This thing is constantly falling, but it's being made up for by this curvature. So it's always, I'm not sure what you mean by every direction, but it is always falling. It's always being accelerated towards this moving object. But it's moving fast enough sideways. Well, you can't see it when I point at the screen, can you? It's moving fast enough this way. And remember, we looked at the demonstration, motion this way isn't affected by the horizontal motion. So it's moving fast enough this way that the fall distance is being made up by the moving distance. And so even though it's constantly falling, it's ending up moving in just a circle. If you want, a kind of a different approach to it is to remember the ball on the string. Right? So the force between the blue and the yellow is the string, and it is pushing this blue ball in a circle. More questions? So while the lights are off, we can. So mostly we've been thinking about two objects, but if we think about three objects, they're all pulling each other together, right? So this is Newton's universal law of gravity. So not only does the sun pull on the Earth, Jupiter pulls on the Earth, Pluto pulls on the Earth, everything acts together. And so this is a picture of three objects that are interacting according to Newton's laws, right? So when they're close, there are big forces and there are big changes in velocity. When they're far, there's less of an effect. And these things are all nicely interacting. What's going to happen eventually is that there's going to be enough of an interaction so that one object is going to escape, which is always a possibility when you have a multi-particle system. This is not the occasion for the escape. That guy is going to come back, being pulled back by the combined pull of red and green. But now,
it's gone,
and it's not coming back. Okay? And you can see very clearly that the red and the blue were both being pulling on each other. One wasn't fixed, and one was orbiting around it. They both had elliptical orbits. And, to remind you of this story, here we're giving this ball some velocity around a more massive object, and it's going to engage in an elliptical orbit, right? It's moving fastest when it's closest to it. We'll call that perihelion. In here where it's far from the sun, aphelion. It's moving relatively slowly. So we have changing orbital speed, changing radius, all of it governed just by Newton's laws. Question?
So the Earth and the Moon are technically like rotating around each other. It's not like this.
Yeah, orbiting around each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but then how those two orbiting, that still doesn't move that system? Those two orbiting?
No, we must go.
I mean, we're moving around.
So if we get rid of the sun, if we just have two bodies, then they would orbit around a fixed point. But just as kind of with the green, red, and blue balls, for a while you saw the red and the blue orbiting around each other with the green off to the side, and then they came together again. So that same thing is the case. The center of the Earth-Moon system is itself orbiting around the sun. And it turns out that the center of the solar system is in turn orbiting around our galaxy. So everything is in motion pretty much at the same time.
Now, is that point between Earth and the Moon pretty close to the center of the Earth?
No, it's not. No, it's not actually in space. It's inside the physical body of the Earth. But I think it's about two-thirds of the way out from the center of the Earth. So if the Moon were more massive, or when it's further out, then that teeter-totter point would be outside of the physical body of the Earth. There's nothing specially different when it's inside the physical body of the Earth than otherwise. More questions? And that actually brings to mind a detail about the tides again. The fact that this bulge leads the moon, it turns out that it leads to a gradual force that is pulling the moon along its orbit. And just as if an astronaut fires his rockets to accelerate this way, the effect is that that goes to a bigger and bigger orbit. So over time, the moon is moving away from the Earth. And we can actually very accurately measure that. It's on the order of centimeters per year because the Apollo astronauts left light reflecting instruments, so we can shine lasers to and from the moon and time how long it takes to go. And we can measure this centimeter per year recession rate of the moon from the Earth. So running the movie backwards, that means that in the past, the moon was a lot closer. And so I don't know if you watch this bad Fox thing, Terra Nova, is that the name of it? I don't know, dinosaurs, people back to the Cretaceous. And they comment in that at that time, the moon was a lot closer, noticeably closer. So eventually, if we wait long enough, the moon will actually be separated from the Earth and will, of course, relatively soon stop having exact total eclipses. Because currently the match between the angular size of the moon and the sun is pretty good. As you move the moon further away, it's not going to block out the sun anymore. It won't be big enough.
So if the moon is getting further away from the Earth, that means that it's not in a perfect orbit.
Correct.
So eventually,
I'm not sure what a perfect orbit means, but I'll go with that.
You were talking about how if you get the right distance away from the Earth and you go at the right speed, then you'll...
So this has nothing to do with that. So this has to do with, in the absence, if we were to turn off the Earth's tides by evaporating, for example, that water off from the Earth, then the moon would happily orbit forever in that same spot. But because this mass is ahead of the moon, it's like there is a body here that's constantly pulling along the moon. So instead of there being only a gravitational force towards the Earth, there's a small force that is constantly accelerating the moon. Okay. It's a small effect, centimeters per year, but it's measured.
So will the moon eventually escape?
Yes.
And then what happens to the moon?
Say again?
So what will happen to the moon?
So it'll
be hanging off somewhere towards the moon.
So it'll stay more or less in the vicinity of the Earth, and there's a pretty good risk that they'll start to get separated by big distances, and then they'll by chance come close together, and there's some chance that they would collide at some future spot. But, you know, it's all over in a billion years anyway, right? Because the sun is gradually getting hotter. More questions? So we got this other kind of cheesy demo to remind you about the nature of heat, and we'll talk more about this in the future. So here we have water in the form of ice, and you can see that the molecules are all in pretty fixed locations. As I increase the temperature, I didn't want to increase it. I guess I can't increase it too much. Now those atoms are moving around, and this is a liquid phase of water. And as I increase the temperature more, we get even more motion of those guys, more kinetic energy, but they're still sitting on the bottom of the can. If I increase the temperature more, most of the water is on the bottom of the can, but we have some evaporated water that's flying around freely. And if I get it hot enough, I can boil that water, so no longer is there any water that's sitting on the bottom of the can. It's all water vapor that's flying around freely, and at higher and higher speeds as I increase the temperature. So if I get it going hotter still, the individual atoms will break apart. So H2O is what water is. You can see some of those H's have disassociated themselves from the O. And if I go hotter still, I break apart all of them. And so every one are individual atoms flying free. So kind of the the mantra that I'll be advertising over time is that high temperature works against composites. So here we have a composite that is ice, many molecules held together, and here we have the situation where we have no molecules held together, but at least H2O is held together, and at higher temperatures still, those guys have broken apart. So at high temperatures, things are going to be in their most elementary form.
When I go to donate plasma, is that the same kind of plasma we're talking about here? Do they break?
No. So there's no relationship between those two words.
Okay.
So the plasma, that what we call the liquid part of your blood is plasma, and has no relationship to what they're calling plasma.
Okay.
More questions? So in order to have this sort of plasma, we need to have temperatures comparable to the surface of the sun, which... not going on inside your body. Yeah, it depends on the actual material, but way hotter than is normal situation. The only kind of natural occurring plasmas on Earth are from lightning bolts. So way hot. Your oven is not plasma.
Can we make plasma?
Sure, yep. There's plasma inside these fluorescent tubes, as we'll talk about eventually. It turns out, and it's pretty surprising, that the gas that's inside these fluorescent tubes is hotter than the surface of the sun. And that seems way out of sense, right? Because you know that the normal sort of light bulbs like those are the ones that you worry about burning yourself on. But they're not nearly as hot as the gas that's inside those tubes. The central filament of those incandescent light bulbs is only about a third the temperature of the surface of the sun. And the gas that's inside those fluorescent tubes is about twice the surface temperature of the sun. So I kind of hope you don't believe me, but when we get to all of this, I hope I'll be able to convince you. Questions? Okay, so that's really what I want to talk about in terms of mechanics, kind of how Newton's laws explain how the solar system works. Forces causing changes or conservation laws leaving things the same. It seems to explain pretty much everything about how the solar system works, except for some very slight details that Einstein corrected circa 1900. Any questions about so-called mechanics? Well, you can see I've got different sort of stuff here, which is the next topic. So, remember we talked about, in terms of the falling rock, that some of the energy was leaving in the form of sound. And sound is going to be our example of a wave. So a wave is something that can carry energy and momentum just like a particle can, but it's not made of individual particles. And while sound is going to be our introduction to waves, our real interest in waves are going to come from light. Because light is the one thing we have from the stars. But the idea is, if we understand how sound works, we'll have a good idea about how light works. So, if we're thinking about a water wave, right, you throw a rock in a pond, what you have are little ripples, and if you were to follow one of those ripples, it would have some speed. And we can invent a vocabulary here, which we'll be using a lot. So the speed of one of these peaks, that's going to be the wave speed. The distance between two peaks or two troughs, that's called a wavelength. If you were sitting on the dock, counting the number of wavelength of peaks that go by a second, that's called the frequency. And if you just kind of do the math, if you count five peaks, each one of which is 2 meters long, then that wave string had to be 10 meters long, and it all happened in 1 second. So it must be that the wave speed is equal to the wavelength times the number of waves per second, which is the frequency. So if I have a high frequency, I must automatically have a short wavelength if the wave speed doesn't depend on those things. It's going to be real helpful to have some symbols for these things, and the usual symbol for wavelength is the one that is hard to remember because it's not a normal alphabetic character for us. It's a Greek lambda. And quite naturally, we're going to use F for frequency and V for speed. So our equation is then going to be that the wave speed is the wavelength times the frequency. Okay, so I drew this in just one dimension, but you know if this were the pond and I throw in the rock, then the waves actually go out in circles, but that's not fundamentally different. Okay, so for water waves, what is waving is the depth of water, right? So here the depth of water is higher than the depth of water is there. So kind of the first thing you should ask about a wave is what's waving? So presumably, with sound, presumably with sound, I don't know if you can see it, I can see it, I can expand it out a little bit, something is going up and down. So what is it? Well, the particles in the air are moving always supersonically, so I don't think I'm going to buy that. We saw in the picture a moment ago the careening molecules, and that's the case, and I think I mentioned it before, you're constantly being hit by supersonic bullets. But they're low mass bullets, so they don't do a lot of damage.
So what's
waving? Something's going up and down for sound. What is it? So separations in the air. So what is a peak? What's different about, for air, right? So presumably I'm going to draw a graph similar to this for sound. What's the difference between this and this? What is it that is changing in the air that is sound? I like that. So what's pressure? I don't know, let's kind of start with numbers. If you fill up your car tires, what do you fill them up to? Say it louder? A certain PSI. What is that certain PSI? Yeah.
35.
Yeah, 35, 30, something like that. Bike tires are maybe 100. So what's the PSI? Yeah, pounds per square inch. So that's high pressure air. It turns out the air in this room has about 15 psi. And what that means is that every square inch of your body is being pushed in with 15 pounds of force by the air. And what that force in the end is all of those bullets bouncing off you. You got all of those supersonic air molecules that are hitting you all the time. They're pushing you in.
So if we were in a vacuum, would we be preloaded then?
Well, so we're pretty well put together people.
Yeah.
So if it's of course not good to put people in a vacuum, but there isn't a big difference. So yes, you're going to expand a little bit. But not a whole lot. So like this rock is very well put together. If I put this rock in a vacuum, it would not change at all. But we're made out of somewhat flabby stuff, so we would expand a little bit. It's not, I hope you know, good to be in a vacuum. So the sort of things that would happen, so the sort of things that happen in the movies are usually way exaggerated. But the long and the short of it isn't good. I remember the scene from the Mars movie, what, Total Recall, right, where the guy's eyes bulge out. Not so. So you can survive very short bouts of vacuum, like, you know, a few seconds. So I think there are other movies where people jump between spacecraft and things like that. That's maybe possible on the margin. Yeah, so the problems really have to do with evaporation from your eyes and your lungs and things like that. So if you just put on a helmet, you'd be pretty good.
That'd be cold though, if it was in space.
Cold or hot? It's kind of a yes or no sort of situation. More questions? Okay, so air pressure is the thing that's going up and down. So if I were to measure the air pressure between my mouth and your ears, it would normally be at this 15 pounds per square inch, but there would be slight cases where we have extra pressure compressions and regions where there was less pressure, rare fractions. And another way of describing what's happening is the air, if we think about, imagine putting little lines in the air so that normally those lines would be equally spaced. If sound is going through this region, what would happen is some of these lines would be pushed together, that would be the high pressure air. Some of these lines would be expanded out, that would be the low pressure air. So here the air has been pushed together, we have a compression. Here the air has been expanded out and we have a rarefaction. So those are the things that are going by your ear, and of course that change in pressure is going to be pushing your eardrum in and out, and in the end that ends up as electrical measurements in your brain which you perceive as sound. So first of all, I'm not sure this was your question. There can't be sound in a vacuum because the sound requires there to be air. And so if by vacuum, by definition, has no air. But your question was?
That's pretty
valid. More questions. So there's one other term that we need to describe waves, and that's the wave height. And that usually goes by the fancy name amplitude. And usually, if you hear about waves on Lake Superior, what they mean by amplitude is the peak to trough distance. But usually what we mean by amplitude is the distance above or below the normal level. That would be what the amplitude would be. So if there are 10 feet, if the meteorologist says there are 10-foot waves on Lake Superior, it means the amplitude is 5 feet. Okay, so we've got some devices here which are supposed to reproduce some sounds for us so we can see what's going on. So I have an artificial sound source. Okay. Now, probably only the closest people can see it, but there's a nice waveform here that's being produced by this box here. So this guy is just measuring the sound that this guy is producing in this speaker. And I can turn various knobs on this device to change this thing. And, boy, I really wish I could read the dial. Ah, here we go. So I can read off the numbers that are on this dial as I turn it. So right now this is at 147. Now it's at 200, 300, 400, 500. This must be stopped. There. 500, 700, 800, 900. There'll be a glitch at 1,000. 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000. You can see the waves are very close together. I can spread them out by changing this instrument. 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000. I don't know if you heard it. There was a glitch at 10,000. I didn't hear it, right? My ears are a lot older than yours. 20,000. Can't hear it now? So let's go backwards from, we're at 23,000. 20,000. So that's 17,000. I can't hear it. 15,000, 14,000. There'll be a glitch at 10,000. I heard that. 9,000, 8,000, 7,000. So you can see the waves are getting bigger. Let me put them closer together again. 5,000, 4, 3, 2, 1, 900, 700, 600, 500, 400, 300, 200. There'll be a glitch at 100. Not a very big glitch. So we're at 90, 80, 70, 60, 50, 40, 30, 20, and on down. Okay, so the numbers that I was reading you off were the frequency. And frequency is measured in cycles per second. And we have a tendency to name things for dead physicists. This is called a hertz. And most recently, we went down from 20,000 hertz to about 20 hertz. Okay, so let's go back to kind of a normal frequency. What's a normal frequency?
440.
Yeah, concert A at 440. Anybody have perfect pitch? I claim that's concert A. So that's one thing I can do. I can also do this. So now I'm varying the amplitude, right? What does the amplitude correspond to?
How loud it is.
How loud it is, yeah. I like that. Right, turning that knob was like turning the volume knob on your stereo. It affected how loud it is. So what was the name for what changed when we did this? Pitch. And as I increase the frequency, let's give it a little bit more amplitude here so we can see it. At least the front people can see it. As I increase the frequency, you can see that the waves got closer together, right? So now I'm going down in pitch and the waves are getting further and further apart. So when I increase the frequency, the wavelength got smaller, and that was, of course, required for them to multiply together to give us the speed of sound. Questions? Yes, question?
So what happens when you combine two sounds? Does it make it louder?
Yeah, they're just simultaneously played. So you can imagine having two people throwing rocks in the pond. So we can simultaneously have two waves present. And that means that there are lots of kind of funny phenomena. So if the first wave was trying to make a trough, just when the second wave was trying to make a peak, they can cancel each other out. So you can get very funny phenomena when you superimpose two sounds. And for people who tune their musical instruments, one of those funny phenomena is called beats. Yeah, so you're a musician, I take it?
Yeah.
So tell the class what beats are. What do you hear?
If you have like 440 and 660 on there, there's not going to be any beating because they're at a 5 to 4 frequency relationship. But if you were to do 440 and 670, then there's going to be a lot of beating because it's not exactly 5 to 4. It's a little bit off, and it's going to have a really kind of complex fraction.
No, I pretty much agree with all that. So when the orchestra is all starting to play an A, what's going on there before they start to do the music? Yeah, they're trying to get in tune with each other. And so I'm not sure you said exactly what beats are, but beats would be changes in the apparent amplitude. So instead of sounding like a steady pitch, it sounds like a warbling pitch. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So here's a tone. There's a tone. What's the difference between them?
This is between.
Yeah. To your 8-year-old kid. One's a higher pitch than the other. Which one's the higher pitch? Yeah, the physically smaller device made a higher pitch than the physically bigger device. So, physically smaller device, physically bigger device, difference in pitch. So there seems to be some correlation between the size of the instrument and the pitch, right? So this is something that I, like a trombone, that I can affect the size of. So I can make it small, I can make it big, I can go in between. So if you think about what this means that the size of the instrument has something to do with the wavelength that it produces. Something that's physically bigger is producing a bigger wavelength and hence a lower pitch than something that is physically smaller. So one last thing to think about while you're going home. So you can tell the difference between a flute playing an A and a violin playing an A. What's the difference? I'm not going to answer that. It's time to quit.
have any extra sheets that you wanted us to do before the lab?
Pre-lab sheets. Yeah. They're, I usually put things back there. So do check your dot status, right? Purple, green. And if it disagrees with what you think, drop me some email.
I'm looking at classes for next semester, and is solar system different than stellar universe?
So the first mod is going to be the same as you've seen from the test, but it's not uncommon for people to take both.
Okay. You,
test?
Yeah.
Joe. So Rob was here. Is he still here? No.
I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. What are the options for taking the class SU?
Oh, it's easy. So up until the second that I hand you the final, you can choose.
Okay. And then if it's S, it's a D or better?
No. So if it's an S, it's, it has to be a C or better. So a CD is a U.
Oh, really?
That's the university policy.
Okay. All right. That's all I was really wondering about, I guess.
I think it'll work out fine.
Okay.
I mean, you should be worried about it, but
yeah.
I wouldn't be overly worried about it. Because you do have this option, and you should, when we reach that point, you should really know what your grade is. You'll have all your, I'll tell you what all your homework and all of your lab is. You know, it'll be only your final exam that's kind of up for grabs.
Okay. The only reason I'm really concerned is I studied a lot more for that test than what I would have expected for a grade. So.
Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
Yep. So the best way to study is to work the exam and bring it in and talk to me about it.
Okay.
And like Amanda actually, I guess I don't recommend this, but what she did because she couldn't hit my office is she faxed it, essentially faxed it to me. She scanned it and let me do it that way by email as opposed to in person. It's, you're not going to get as good feedback that way, but it's better than nothing. Because you can be happily answering those questions and be getting the wrong answers.
Yeah, because I listened to the screencast, so I thought I was, but I think I just got a lot of the bigger point questions wrong, like the main things.
I can't remember what your scores were. But it is, I mean, it's, so the, another thing that happens is people kind of, one of the students commented that they spent too much time on the true and false, you know, which is...
I probably did that too, actually.
It's not worth a lot of points, or maybe said differently, it's worth a lot of points, but even if you guess, you get 50% of the points. So the kind of the most important thing to be concentrating on are the short answer questions. That's usually where people differ the most.
Okay.
But for the next exam, you know, work it, work through the, one of those exams and come in and talk to me about it.
Okay.
Or email it to me if you don't want to talk to me about
all
it.
All right, sounds good. Thank you.
So green dot is moon.
Green dot is the second one, which is the
constellation.
The constellation
okay,
one.
Okay, and we just have to scan that and email it to you?
Yes.
Okay.
So you've done that and but not
yes.
scanned it to me.
Correct.
Good. Okay.
And then the moon one we have to have scanned you by like the 10th, is it?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Sometime moderately soon will be good enough.
Is there any cool stuff in the sky going on right now? I brought my telescope home or from home here to this.
So I'm not sure what cool stuff in the sky is. So the how big is your telescope?
I guess I don't remember the exact thing, but it's probably about this long or something. And it's just it's probably about that big a radius or something.
So probably the most interesting thing to look at is Jupiter.
Okay.
And so Jupiter is currently rising at maybe 9 o'clock or something like that. So going out at midnight or something like that, or just waiting a month, would be good to look at Jupiter. And of course the moon is always fun to look at. I don't think, so Venus is now an evening star, but I haven't really noticed it. It must be so close to the sun that it's not visible. Or at least, as I say, I haven't noticed it yet. So you kind of switch labs, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to have lab on Wednesday, and we'll look at some things with binoculars.
Okay.
So the nicest thing to look at is Saturn.
Really?
But Saturn isn't available to us. It's a morning star.
Yeah, I've got like the regular eyepiece, and then I think there's one that says 2x on it. Does that mean it doubles whatever goes through it? Okay, because I haven't figured out why that isn't working. Because I pointed at the moon without it, and then I put that piece in there and put it back in there, and I can't see anything. So there must be like something in there. Might have to clean the lens.
Oh, it's unlikely for it to be so dirty that you can't see.
Well, it's
the
really,
moon.
I guess it was like I'd look and it'd be the moon, and then I'd put it in there, and it would be just a white fuzz.
Oh, you have to refocus it almost certainly when you put it in.
Yeah, and I would do that and it wouldn't really change it, so I don't really know what's wrong with that piece.
Well, I think that it's focused myself, but it is, if you look at that eyepiece, it's not just a single lens, it's usually a couple lenses, so it's possible for one of those to get deranged and not be super obvious, but it's pretty rare.
Okay.
I think it's most likely focus.
Okay.
And it's possible if it's not, if it came with your telescope, it must work,
yes.
But it is... If it didn't come with your telescope, it's possible that there's no focus setting that'll work.
I think it came with the telescope, so it must just, you have to mess with it a little more.
And the moon is the thing to look at for focusing for that, and it's a good time to look at the moon because it's not too bright right now, and it's up at reasonable times.
Mm-hmm.
You can also, of course, do the same thing during the day.
Focus it during the day?
Focus it, yeah. Look at, you know, a tree or something.
Yeah. Something came with it too. That's like this tiny little circle, and it has sun written on it. I really don't know. It's like almost like a weight. I guess I just didn't know.
It has sun written on it. S-U-N.
Yeah.
So my guess is that it's for eyepiece, so-called eyepiece projection. And so you're never going to use your telescope to look at the sun. And I would probably not bother to do this. But one of the things you can do is you can aim this thing at the sun and put a white card behind it. And you get a view of the sun, and if there are sun spots on it, you would notice it.
Okay.
But currently there aren't any big sun spots, and aiming your telescope at the sun always seems like a dangerous thing to do. It's not supposed to be harmful, but I don't do it.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so this stuff wants to stay. This wants to all go. For the time being, take this bird away. This wants to go. These want to go. Oh, I've got my self turns on still.